This is the ACIA New Horizons podcast. Everything we discuss is for the analyst, to the analyst, and by the analyst.
Today, I am talking with Vaz, a doctor from the University of Portsmouth. Introduce yourself, please. Let us know what you do and what you're doing currently within University of Portsmouth.
Hi, Paige. Thank you for inviting me. So my name is Dr. Vasilios Karagiannopoulos. I'm a reader in cybercrime and cybersecurity at the University of Portsmouth. I work for the Institute of Criminal Justice Studies, and I'm also the director of the Cybercrime Awareness Clinic, and we'll probably talk about the clinic a little bit later.
Sure. Yes. And I've looked at some of your past research. You've done a lot with hacktivism. What did you find? What was the findings of that?
Interesting question. So I did my PhD on hacktivism a few years back, and I've published a book about hacktivism called Living with Hacktivism, From Conflict to Symbiosis. And I've recently also published a chapter in a book called Rethinking Cybercrime, which talks about hacktivism. So what did I find? So hacktivism, first of all, is a very contested kind of concept. And that was partly why I was intrigued and wanted to explore the concept a little bit more. It has been excessively used by the media. So everyone has a very different conception of what hacktivism is, essentially. The particular aspect of hacktivism that I was interested in was pretty much using hacking as a political form of protest. And this meant people doing virtual sit-ins. So these would be essentially distributed denial of service attacks with a lot of people against the website, or virtual graffiti, which is essentially web defacements, and so on. So part of my work was to explore the limits of legality and the limits of illegality of these activities. And there was a lot of discussion, especially previously, even before Anonymous became a thing, as to whether these activities had some political legitimacy, whether they could be considered free speech, whether they could be considered civil disobedience, whether the criminal justice system should deal with activists and hacktivists engaging in such activities in a more lenient kind of way. And in my book, I'm exploring all these concepts, and I'm trying to find alternative ways of dealing with such activities beyond just criminalizing and putting people in prison.
That's very interesting. So is this an ongoing sort of research, or did you finish off with the chapters within the book in your book as well?
It is a general interest of mine. So I am following developments and so on. In my mind, hacktivism sort of goes through different waves of increased activity or decreased activity. And at the moment, for example, we are seeing a relative reduction compared to a huge increase that we saw 10 years ago with Anonymous, for example, when they were making the media every day and various different reports were characterizing, you know, this is the year of hacktivists and so on. So it was quite big at the time.
Yeah. Could you define, so for me personally, I've never looked into, you know, this area. What is hacktivism? Now I can guess, but I don't think that it will be, you know, spot on. So could you explain to me what that is?
Yeah, so as I said at the beginning, you know, there's various different combinations depending on your perspective and where you're coming from. Focus I had in relation to hacktivism was essentially using hacking techniques in order to communicate a political message online and create discussion about issues. So as I mentioned, you could go and hack into a website and deface the front page of a website in order to protest, let's say, employment conditions that a particular corporation might be having and using. you could perhaps do a virtual sit-in, which, as I said, is a distributed denial of service attack with loads of people actually coordinating and accessing a particular website and reloading that website using automated software. Let's say you would access a particular website of a political figure or a political party in order to make that website go down or slow down as part of a political protest. And essentially, these are some of the examples. There's various other examples. People have created viruses that infect computer systems, but they only communicate political messages as part of the payload of the virus. They don't cause any damage, for example. It's quite a big scene, and a lot of it is below the surface in terms of what the majority of us see in the media as well. So there's a very artistic branch to hacktivism at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, activist branch. And then obviously we can go into a lot more vigilantist kind of activities, such as stealing information and then exposing confidential information in order for people to take revenge or avenge, let's say, some political corruption incident or some police violence incident.
Listen to you speak, it seems like this crime is very sophisticated. And actually, the individuals that are committing this crime, it can be argued, are quite clever because it's not, well, from my experience, I wouldn't be able to hack into an internet page or a political party sort of page. I wouldn't know how to do that. So how are they learning how to do these things?
So there's various different levels of activity. So the virtual sit-in, for example, is probably the most simple you could do. In the sense that if you, let's say, belong to a political party and that political party or a political movement, not party necessarily, a political movement, but let's say that political group decides that they want to participate in a protest of the kind that I described as a virtual sit-in, then they would have their own software that you could download, and it automates the page reloading process on your browser, for example. So they would coordinate with everyone that wants to take part. And then the only thing to do is download the software, put the URL of the website on your software, and then let it play. And it just automates the process of reloading that page. So if we get, let's say, 10,000 people to do it, 20,000 people to do it, the traffic that software would generate on a general level could cause some websites to crash or at least slow down.
Wow.
It's a very simple way. Yeah, I'm not talking about the people that build software. This might be a little bit more complicated, but if you wanted to take part in such a protest, then it doesn't really require a lot of technical expertise apart from being able to, you know, use a computer, download software and use it. And it's a very straightforward kind of piece of software. With the more elaborate hacks, yes, of course, you know, if we're talking about people that are hacking into law enforcement agencies, web pages, or governmental web pages, you can imagine there's quite a lot of cybersecurity controls there that they would have to bypass. So we are talking about at least a little bit more seasoned technically individuals, if not very high level hackers that would be involved in this political kind of group.
Well, this is the first time I've sort of heard about this, and it's very interesting. I'm not saying I'm going to go participate in this kind of activity because I'd probably get arrested, but it is a very interesting topic.
There are legal implications and serious legal implications, especially in the US and the UK. People have been prosecuted for participating.
How did you become part of the Cybercrime Awareness Clinic? How did that happen? I can see the link, but explain.
Yes. So the Institute of Criminal Justice Studies in Portsmouth has very strong collaborations with Hampshire Constabulary. And we were discussing about developing an initiative that would provide some community support in relation to cybercrime, assist the police in terms of dealing with incidents of cybercrime, but also becoming more aware of what the problems are in the community and how to better support victims. Me and my colleague, Dr. Lisa Segura, we developed a proposal that related to essentially, well, a clinic is perhaps a bit too specific for what this has become at the moment. But the idea was that we would support the community by going out and offering advice and guidance, doing research as well, and then also allowing people to come to visit us and have one-to-ones and get more tailored advice in terms of what they were facing in relation to cybercrime, obviously. So that's how it started. It's been going for 4 years now. Yeah. We're very happy about that.
Not to mention that you were the winner for the National Cyber Awards.
Yes, so the initial project that kickstarted, let's say, the clinic just won an award in September as a National Cyber Awareness Award, essentially, and we're very proud of that.
Absolutely. And what you just discussed earlier, that all that information can be found in the Ports of Cybercrime Awareness Clinic projects, right? The key findings and recommendations that was published in 2019. And I've had a scroll through that. And there was one statement that popped out, and it was suggested this was an eye-opener and a multi-factorated experience. And I guess you all saw things and learned a lot about this field.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to be an academic and read the relevant literature and research.
Yeah.
But I think the combination of being an academic and doing that, and at the same time being able to go out and actually speak to the people that are facing the problems, to businesses. We focused on three particular areas at the beginning of the project. Now we've expanded a little bit more. But the initial categories that we focused on were young people in schools and colleges, small and medium businesses and charities, and older people of 60 plus years. And obviously every particular area that we focused on had its own kind of special issues that came up. So it was a very organic project. You start with you think it's a clear idea. It's not ideally, but you think you have an idea of what you're going to do and how it's going to happen. But the project sort of developed its own organic nature and developed in various different ways that we hadn't anticipated. And other things that we thought would be really successful were not as successful. And, you know, we created new things that we never really anticipated before that we would. So yes. That's the eye-opening part of the experience, I guess.
And are you still working with Hampshire Police, or have you broadened out now to other police services in the UK?
Yeah, now we are, we're regularly working with Hampshire Police. So the clinic has expanded quite significantly since the first project. So we are now funded by the European Commission, and we're involved in a project called Orpheus, which focuses on the online and offline counter-radicalization of young people. And it involves partners from the two seas area, so the south of England, the north of France, and then parts of the UK in the Netherlands and Belgium. We are also working with the National Cybersecurity Centre on a national campaign to increase cyber awareness for small and medium businesses. And I also participated in a project that involved the constabulary, and it was funded by CREST. So the Centre for Research and Evidence of Security Threats. And that focused on the moral injury and trauma suffered by police investigators working in child abuse cases online.
Yes.
And the exposure to that kind of imagery. At the moment, we're also working with with the constabulary and the Office of the Police and Crime Commissioner in Hampshire, with the Cyber Ambassadors Initiative, which is essentially a peer-to-peer kind of provision of cyber awareness advice with young people. So the trainers in the project train young people in cyber awareness related topics, and then they go into schools and they speak to other young people, and will be involved in that in the coming months.
Yes. And obviously at the moment we're in lockdown, COVID has ruined a lot of plans. Is the training still going ahead, or is there now alternative ways you're
Yes, it is. It's taken a while to reconfigure everything. So obviously, as you can imagine, a lot of our activities involve law enforcement agencies and other relevant stakeholders. And especially during lockdown one, everyone was taken by surprise, let's say, in the first few months. So we've had some delays in terms of the rollout of what we were planning to do. But obviously, as with the university itself, we've had to sort of reconfigure our modus operandi. So in that sense, yes, obviously, we can't really go out and meet people in person, but we have created a lot of alternatives in terms of online provision, online webinars and seminars and talks and resources that we can share. And we're hoping that in the coming months, things will become a little bit more open and we will be able to resume with our face-to-face provision as well.
Well, I hope so. I mean, yeah, it's been a struggle for a lot of us in the academic world. Well, exactly. I think everyone listening will probably sigh, like, yeah, lockdown again. So in terms of tackling cybercrime, so obviously this is a very, you know, this is a global problem. Cybercrime doesn't just happen here in the UK, it happens everywhere. Have you identified then any problems with how cases are handled here within UK police forces? Or
yeah, definitely. So this is a sensitive topic, as you can imagine, to discuss. But what we can say is, initially, the main problem was that people were not very familiar with the concept and the various ways that cybercrime would materialize in everyday life. And that was a few years ago. But in the past, let's say, 5 to 8 years, there's been a significant investment in educating law enforcement agencies about cybercrime, more investment in getting more people that are familiar with cybercrime and how to deal with cybercrime. So we are seeing a lot more law enforcement individuals actually being far more capable than what the predecessors would be in terms of dealing with the problem. There's, of course, the issue of cutbacks and staff reductions that might have impacted in the capacity of law enforcement agencies to deal with all the problems. And there are also some systemic problems with cybercrime that prevent law enforcement agencies from effectively dealing. And this is obviously that cybercrime can happen from a different jurisdiction, and it can target a huge amount of victims. So if we're talking about a phishing campaign, phishing emails can target thousands of people. And then obviously you have a respective amount of people falling for these phishing emails. At the same time, you know, it's a matter of resource, how much money can you throw into law enforcement in relation to cybercrime when you've got a lot of other big issues that you're dealing with in terms of the everyday kind of crime that we see. So knife crime, for example, is big on the agenda as well. But as you can imagine, with COVID and everything transitioning online, this is becoming even more important now. So in that sense, yeah, from what we've seen from our research, law enforcement agencies are far more prepared at the moment and far more knowledgeable. And I think the main aspect that needed perhaps more effort is communicating the advice in a more accessible way and victim support, providing a more hands-on support to victims of cybercrime in terms of feeling that their case has been dealt with properly and there is a follow-up and so on.
Victim support comes up in a lot, you know, when we discuss hate crime, there's a lack of victim support. And I guess that comes down to the understanding of what the victim needs. There is underreporting sometimes. We don't know what's going on. We need to become more proactive. But how can you be proactive when tackling cybercrime?
Well, I mean, as you say, when cybercrime has happened, being proactive might not result in something really useful, because if someone has stolen money and they are somewhere abroad, it's not very easy to recover that money. So it's just a matter of finding ways of dealing with you know, the feelings of the victim, or supporting them in terms of potentially getting a refund from their bank. The focus at the moment in terms of cybercrime is obviously in prevention. And there is a lot of advice out there from multiple channels and vectors that communicates advice to individuals, businesses, everyone essentially, in terms of how they can prevent information compromises, how they can prevent falling for frauds, and so on. If it happens, there is advice in terms of reporting and in terms of maybe seeking some refund from a potential kind of bank or insurance, for example, that you might have. Cyber insurance is becoming a big issue at the moment. But the main thing is it shouldn't happen, or at least you can do anything you can to prevent it, or you should do anything you can to prevent it. Because then it's difficult to recover from it.
Yes. And I guess this crime happens because there are opportunities for offenders to do so. What do you think's changed within this field? Why has it become so easy for offenders to do this?
Well, I mean, there's two main elements. There's more victims, more potential victims, and there's a lot more devices and technologies that people can implement. So the more technology becomes popularized and more people start using it, the easier it becomes for people to use that technology for nefarious purposes. And I think this case is no different. When you have more people online using more devices, then you have a lot more victims, more potential victims, and a lot different vectors of attack. You have social media platforms now that people are on all the time. They expose personal information. So before, what we call the revolution of Web 2.0, which brought us essentially the internet that is based on user-generated content, and this means, you know, all these wikis and social media networks, like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and so on. It wasn't as straightforward to find a lot of information for people, so you can trick them into clicking on links or defraud them in general, or hack into their computers and so on. Now we're very exposed, and a lot of us don't even know how exposed we might be. It's really interesting, and you would probably know even better than I do how intelligence and then open source intelligence analysis works. So whenever I participate in workshops regarding open source intelligence, it's really interesting to see what people can come up with. And I even do exercises with my students where I ask them to look at my social media, and I'm quite cautious. Or I would like to believe I am, and see if they can find a way of tricking me into believing that something is legitimate when it's not.
Yes.
We can be careful, but the main thing is to discuss the risk with everyone that would tag you or use your information or share your photo on their social media and so on. So irrespective of how careful you might be, you might get exposed because someone else is not being careful with your information.
Yes. So in terms of the clinic then, How have you contributed to eliminating these challenges that we face as a society?
So the first part of the clinic, the project that we did with Hampshire Constabulary, for example, apart from going out and doing workshops and seminars for people and providing advice and support, and even doing one-to-ones. So we helped some organizations in terms of developing information policies or figuring out what the risks might be and trying to deal with them. What we have done is also work with the police in terms of advising them and in terms of helping them provide better support and improve their service in terms of cybercrime. And at the moment, we're working on various different projects, as I mentioned. So, for example, the work we're doing currently with the National Cyber Security Center, we are going out and working with growth hubs and delivering educational sessions to growth hub advisors, so business advisors that would go out to businesses, and then they can support the businesses in this particular area. We do publish work that's related to our activities as well, so people can read our work and find out more about the issues that they are interested in. We organize talks with various different speakers, either from the University of Portsmouth or external speakers that are educational talks and talk about different issues relating to cybercrime. So these are open for the public to attend, and we advertise them widely. And we do have a website. I'm hoping you'll be able to share the website. And the website provides information and advice and links to a lot of support charities and services in relation. I think it's important to consider what the issues are for every particular category, and then also try to speak the language that every particular group we're interacting with is understanding and finds accessible and finds relatable as well. So we've spoken with young people in schools and colleges, but we've also spoken with the parents. We've spoken with the schools and the colleges themselves and their teachers and the lecturers in the colleges and the schools. We have even worked with nurses working in schools, social workers. So we are quite diverse in terms of who we're trying to reach. And I believe this is a change. So everyone should be aware and everyone should be able to support each other.
Yes. And across seas. So that leads me to my final question, where I guess you're talking on behalf of everyone that's involved within the clinic here. But where do you see the clinic in 5 years' time?
Ooh, that's a...
it's a hard one.
Hard one. Well, as I said, you know, the clinic started as an initial project with Hampshire Constabulary, and we've now expanded. We are using the clinic not just as part of existing projects that I mentioned, but we are also offering the opportunity to our students to join the clinic as part of their undergraduate degree in criminology and cybercrime that we offer, or as part of their MSc in cybercrime as volunteers, and take part in some of the projects that we are running or planning to run, or help us co-design some small projects that they can be involved with. And I think the clinic is becoming more like a hub now, more like a research center, rather than what it started out to be, like a very localized project. And I think in 5 years' time, I would like us to see, I would like to see us grow more and become more like a research and innovation center for cyber awareness, involved in various different projects across various different fields. We now have a lot of colleagues in different areas of cybercrime, from, you know, the very technical hacking and so on, the hacktivism I mentioned, all the way to gender violence online, and fraud, and a lot of different issues. So there is a lot of potential.
There's a lot of potential, and hopefully in the next 5 years I can then speak to you again and see how many of them you've ticked off. Bas, it was lovely talking to you today, and thank you so much for joining me and sharing your experience and expertise in this field, because
thank you for giving me the opportunity. And as you said, we're very open for everyone who's interested to contact us. We're very open to collaboration. So please do reach out. And if you have a problem, visit the site and communicate with us and try to get some support.